Hey everyone, nice to see you. Welcome to our morning module session. We're at module four. So this is the first of our practice modules, if you like. And we're going to have seven of these. We're going to spend 2 weeks on each of the seven practice modules. We've also got a bit of a break built in for summer here in the Northern Hemisphere. And I think we're all in the Northern Hemisphere. And of course, Cassie, the weather's just nice forever for you. So, and that's gonna, over the next seven practice modules, the idea is that we are gonna be playing with approaches and concepts and tools that really help you to support your clients to understand their self-doubt, make sense of it, kind of own it in a new way from their healthy adult self, get a real grasp on the parts of them that are involved in this story of self-doubt and the lived reality of it as well, right? So, our focus over these practice modules is really about getting into the world of the client and really understanding who they are and why this makes sense to them, why their self-doubt is understandable. So one of the real kind of baseline principles of this work is that self-doubt is always here for a really good reason. So what I have found is that a lot of coaching is focused on denying that, right? It's actually about, no, you're just telling yourself a story. You've made something up here about yourself that fundamentally isn't true. Or if you just stopped believing that you couldn't, that you can't do something, that somehow you will magically be able to do that. And this approach just never felt okay to me, and I'm really hot on the mindset aspect of this too, right? Because a lot of coaching is about managing our mind. I believe that it's actually more respectful of our clients and way more effective for us as practitioners if we take a starting place of, this makes complete sense. Let's find out why. Then we never make the client wrong. And importantly, we never get into a battle with their protective self-doubt, where we're basically just saying, no, you're wrong. This, you know, this person can do this thing. And the protector's like, it's not safe. So we're never going to get into that conversation with our clients. As self-belief coaches, we go in with, well, I wonder why this is happening. Like, I wonder what is going on here. Why does this make sense to you? Why does it feel safer to you, dear client, to hold yourself back from something we both know you really want? Like, what is going on for you? And how do we unpick and unpack that so that you feel brave enough to experiment with trying some other things out? Because we know what the result is if you carry on with this approach, and that there is at some point, there is a tension between what the client wants and that protective self-doubt. That's why they're already in that battle, right? So we want to support them to understand this in a new way. So that's kind of the journey we're going to go on together, the J word, that we're going to go on together over the following modules. And we're starting today with the root causes of self-doubt. So we're going to spend a couple of weeks on looking at this. I think, honestly, it's one of my favorite things to talk about. I think it's really the secret sauce of this approach to this work. So many approaches to coaching around self-doubt completely ignore the root causes of it. I just want to deny or bypass or move around it and ignore it. So my hope is that certainly with modules 4 and 5, by the time we complete modules 4 and 5, you're going to have some really powerful coaching tools that are specifically designed to really help your clients understand where their self-doubt is coming from and to start to play with experimenting with new ways of being and doing. I've organized this quite intentionally because these two modules in particular are ideal for setting up a single session. So if you wanted to start playing with a single session approach to coaching, and I recommend 90 minutes as an ideal sort of time frame to do that, these are the kinds of approaches that will really support your clients and help you to feel equipped to get somewhere really powerful within 90 minutes. So I'm thinking about this from a practical element as well, right? How can you start to implement this into your practice and make some freaking money, right? Because this is super valuable to our clients. So I've got a guide that comes out with module 5 on how to set up a single session. And this is based on some really great evidence around the effectiveness of single session therapy. Did you know that the highest number of sessions that anyone has in therapy is one? Right. So this approach has been developed out of that. Right. If we're only going to have one session with someone, how can we have the most impact? So across the board, the most people that have therapy, by far the highest number of sessions that people have is one, the most common. Right. So this has come out of Wendy Dryden's work, who was a mentor of mine many years ago. And he said, right, if we've only got them for one session, let's have a really good go. So there's some really good research around this. I've also found personally that when you make an impact with someone in 90 minutes, they're more likely to say, more please, more please. So it's a great way of kind of low-key marketing this work and starting to attract clients that will want to work with you for a longer term. So that's kind of where we're heading over the next two modules, give you a really good grounding in how to look at self-doubt with clients and how to bring an additional offer into your practice if you wish. Okay, so let me, with that intro, let me start with today's call. I'm just going to touch a little bit on practice pods and making sure you're all set up for those. And then we're going to talk about the aims of this module and how we're splitting it over these 2 weeks. Okay, so what we're going to look at this week and next week. And we're going to do some coaching in this call with each other. And I'm going to coach, someone's going to volunteer and I'm going to coach them, which is fun. And the idea behind this, and you'll find this with our practice modules, is we do the practice of coaching, is because this helps you to start playing with the material without waiting for perfect conditions, right? While you're supported, and you get to see me do some demos as well, which can sometimes be helpful just in terms of words and approaches. Yeah. And we'll also have some suggestions for some things you can look at in your practice pods around this module and this session. Okay. The chat is very much open. Please feel free to put questions in there or just raise your hand, interrupt me as we go. Let's make this really interactive. And we will be having some coaching processes as we go through. Yeah. So I just want to make sure that everyone knows who's in their practice pod and you've all at least made contact, if not met up yet. Yeah, anyone not done that? Okay, so Kirsty and Irina, have you made contact with your people or received contact? No? Have you received the email?
Yeah, we have to still. We're at the same pod with Kirsty.
Okay.
And Colleen, I think, or Colette. Sorry, I don't remember the name exactly. Yeah.
Okay, great. Can one of you take the lead on making sure that that happens sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I was thinking to send email after this session. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if you just meet up and have that initial session, what we found is the longer that first session takes to get started, the more behind you're likely to feel, even though being behind is a bit of a myth, but it just gets you in that momentum. So, yeah. And everyone else, Scott, Cassie, Jane, you've all kind of made contact, either met up or got a plan to meet up. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Great. There is also, we had Scott ran a session last Thursday around setting up practice pods, and the recording of that is in the call library. So if for whatever reason you missed it, and I know there was a slight confusion, which was totally my fault around the Zoom link, we have sorted that out now for future calls. It started 5 minutes late because I put in the wrong Zoom link, but that's been resolved. So if you wanted to watch the replay of that, you can do that. Yeah. Okay, Kirsty. Yeah, cool. So overwhelming. Do you want to say a bit more about that? Oh, you're muted, love.
Yeah, I actually only watched them this morning. And it was the life map one. And yeah, just like massive I'm gonna cry talking about it. Jesus. It was like a massive revelation for me, and I ended up sobbing all the way through. My husband came, as I got up at 5 this morning, and my husband came down about 7, found me in floods of tears, and he was like, "Are you all right?" And I was like, "No, but yes." And so, yeah, I think I need to kind of work through that a bit before I start coaching other people on it, or I'm going to be no use to them until I deal with this stuff myself. But yeah, it was interesting. Like, you know, when you have like a theory, which of the fears shows up for you the most? And there was something really strange, like the life map. I was looking at what you'd put on yours. And I was thinking, like, there was a theme to all of the things that were coming into my head. And it was all to do with rejection. And it was really weird. It's like I wasn't remembering any of the things like getting my degree or doing well at work. It was all about the time that that group of friends turned their back on me, or that particular friend turned their back on me. And like, it was just so powerful. Just needed to mention that. It was good shit.
I appreciate you sharing this so much, because this is exactly why we do this on our own first, right? Is then what happens, I think, is A, we have deeper empathy about what might happen for our clients, but also I think on a really practical level, you're talking from your own experience rather than about something that is a nice theory. That has weight, that has real magnetism for your clients as well. So
you can see that. Yeah.
And you'll find I'm pretty open about sharing this stuff too, because I feel like I'm just going around in a labyrinth of this work for probably the rest of my life. So yeah, completely. You've had this release this morning, which is lovely.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. Cool. Okay. Let's have a little look at module 4. So we're talking about the root causes of self-doubt. And there's two parts to the root causes, right? There's the client's biography, right? The kind of raw data, the client's experience, like, who are you? What's happened to you? So in the processes we use to kind of to look at this, what Kirsty's just described, I bet you're all excited as all hell to get into your life maps now. But yeah, the life map, where we kind of put our life on a page and just get a real objective perspective, or semi-objective perspective. It's quite rare for us and for our clients to look at our experiences in one place, and it can really help to draw out, like, because he shared some themes and ideas and things that are curious, things that we might want to look at. It's an amazingly helpful resource for clients with self-doubt to see, oh my goodness, the seeds were planted early for me to be sensitive to this thing, right? Often before I even had a way of making sense of it. So uncovering the client's biography, we use just questions, asking questions about the person and the life map are the main kind of ways in to getting a sense of who this beloved person is that's sitting in front of you. And the second approach is uncovering the protective beliefs, right? So once we get a sense of what the client has experienced, and they do too, because often this will draw out memories or themes that they might not have put together before, we're starting to get a sense of what has this led to in terms of the client's way of making sense of themselves and the world. How do they make meaning out of what has occurred in their lives? So we're getting more of a sense of what are these experiences mean to the client, right? So we're really stepping in this module, we're really stepping into the client's worldview. And, you know, just hold in your mind the first three modules around trauma and how that may have shown up in the client's biography, how their sense of themselves, their sort of self-concept has formed over time, what stage they may be at in terms of, you know, are they quite identified with other people? Do they have a sense of themselves, or are they pretty comfortable with lots of paradox and contradictions? You know, get a sense of that. And the reason that these aspects are important in terms of root causes is that it helps us to understand how we might approach coaching the client. Yeah. Yeah, Scott, can you unmute yourself, love? Thanks.
Yeah, no worries. First and foremost, apologies. I was like, I struggled getting in on the link that you sent. So I went into the website and got through back there, fine, no problem. So, if you could elaborate a little bit with regards to when we talk about people being identified with other people?
Yeah.
Is that in your view, and when we look at things from a cultural perspective, or if you look at things from, you know, I'm just picking on someone here, but, you know, you might look at a football fan, for argument's sake, who's identified with his way of life, is identified with a certain football.
I'm just gonna interrupt you there, Scott, because by talking about that, like, how do they identify? Is it through their own self-concept with other people, or more comfortable with a mix? I'm referring very specifically to what we talked about in module two around the developmental stage of the client.
Ah, got you. Okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So if a client is coming to us and a lot of their self-doubt is tied up in what other people might think, it's usually an indicator that they're quite identified with other people's opinions of them. Their sense of identity comes from everyone else.
That's a bit of an aha moment for me, so thank you.
It's totally fine. Cool. And look, you know, we're all just absorbing quite a lot at the moment, so please, it's a brilliant question. Yeah,
thank you. Cheers. Thank you.
Cool. Okay, so those two things, like the client's biography, what has occurred in their lives, their experiences, their relationships, and how they've made sense of that, all helps us to have an approach to coaching them that's really going to support both our way in and their the impact that this will have for them, right? So remember in module one, we talked about the self-doubt loop, how self-doubt shows up. We're contemplating doing something and we feel the sense of alarm, like it's safer for me to hold back. I shouldn't probably do this. Whether it's, you know, sending an email to a colleague that feels a little edgy, or it's, you know, posting something on social media, for example. We have a sense of discomfort around that. It's like often a body sensation, or we might have an emotion or a thought around it, a memory. We might start to predict the future. What might happen if I do this? All of that discomfort is caused by that alarm, right? And so we'll get into those six P's of resistance in order to comfort ourselves around this discomfort. So we procrastinate, or we start proving ourselves, working really hard at it. We get perfectionist, or we start looking at other people placating or people pleasing them. We go passive, or we get into kind of paralysis where we're like, oh, I don't really know what to do. If our we usually have a few favorite ways that we resist that discomfort of self-doubt. And over time, that can form a pattern. And you may have said this about yourself as well. I'm totally a people pleaser, or I'm such a procrastinator. And to me, that pattern is simply the way that you've learned to take care of yourself when you feel this sense of alarm. So the pattern is not actually part of your identity. It's just a way that you've protected yourself from that discomfort. We don't actually know who you are underneath that. If we supported you to figure out a way to be with that discomfort in a way that's actually helpful and supportive and feels safe, who knows what patterns may or may not disappear. So when we come in going, well, there's always a real reason for self-doubt, instead of worrying about, let's do some hacks on how to stop procrastinating, right? Ever seen that in the coaching world? Instead, we're looking at, why is that alarm going off? Why are you feeling that discomfort? Let's assume there's a really bloody good reason why, when you've started sending that email to your colleague, there's an alarm that's gone off and you've thought, oh, I can't just trust myself to do this. I've got to overthink it and worry about it. And oh my goodness, then I'm caught up in all of the discomfort and the resistance. Right. So our approach to our client's self-doubt is always, I wonder why that's happening. I'm going to assume it's there for a really good reason. Yeah. And this normalizes the client's experience. It's like we may be the first person to say, I wonder why that's happening. You found a really good way to protect yourself over here in this resistance, but I wonder why that's happening in the first place. Why do you feel that need to protect yourself? Right. So our focus is shifting. We want to know, why is that alarm activated? And this is really key, because what I have found is that it is always, that alarm is always being activated for a good reason. Always. I've yet to come across an experience where there isn't a good reason. So our job as the coach helping this client make sense of that experience is to pretty much ignore, certainly at the start of our relationship with the client, we're kind of ignoring all of this stuff and we're focusing on that alarm. Why are you particularly sensitive to that situation? Why has this alarm gone off in this context? Right? It's going to be personal and subjective and very specific for each client. And often I think we get confused. Like, how is it I can do this thing that objectively feels quite brave and big, but this thing feels really freaking edgy and vulnerable, and it makes me hold back, right? It's because whatever's feeling risky to you is setting off an alarm. That alarm represents your sensitivity to a risk. And I found there are 7 big risks: rejection, conflict, success, judgment, failure, complexity, disappointment. We'll come back to these and talk about these more as we go. But it's like, oh, these are the reasons, right? I've got a sensitivity to a particular risk: rejection, conflict, success, judgment, failure, complexity, or disappointment. It's not an accident that those risks feel sensitive to me, that particular risks feel sensitive. And you may even, just as I read those out, you may even think, oh yeah, there are particular risks that I feel a bit about. Yeah? Yeah, Scott?
Can you just elaborate a little bit on fear of success with that?
Why? Well, tell me, Scott, why would someone be why would someone find success vulnerable or risky?
In case they didn't achieve it.
So that would be a fear of failure.
Yeah. Right?
But what if you are successful? What's risky about that? Anyone else got ideas? Feel free to share.
A little bit.
Not out.
Smiley, please.
That is losing that success maybe at some point.
Yeah, there's more to lose. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might isolate you, might put you out on your own. Yeah. You might feel you lose a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
Or attract negative people as well, depending on success.
Yeah. Can attract a lot of, I've worked with quite a lot of people who've achieved success, popularity, whatever we want to call it, around, a social media following. They've been quite well-known influencer type people, and they attract a shit ton of judgment from other people. So they may be getting like all these brand endorsements and all of that good stuff, looking successful, but then what does that do when you also attract a ton of judgment? Yeah
that makes a lot of sense.
So just notice that. Which of the risks feel a little edgy for you? Yeah, which ones feel like, oh yeah, I know that one comes up. And the thing is that our clients and us humans, we're unlikely to know why we're sensitive to a particular risk. And what I'm saying about that is there's the kind of intellectual knowing, right? Oh, it doesn't feel good when I get criticized. Of course, I would be sensitive to that, right? But actually, there will be specific personal reasons why a risk feels particularly sensitive, or we feel particularly sensitive to it. It's built in, right? We have sometimes a visceral response to those risks. You may know these as the kind of classic stress responses of fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Yeah, so it's like, oh, I freeze when I get criticized and I don't know what to say. Or I fawn, right? I tend to minimize my own experience, whatever. Yeah. So that resistance can kind of be built in, baked in. And then we're just in that state. It's like an automatic response. We can also have like automatic assumptions based on those patterns, right? Like a client would just start off by contemplating doing something, like embarking on a change in behavior or a new project. And then the alarm goes off because they've got this assumption, well, I just don't finish things. So I can't have that. So I'm going to stop. And they hold themselves back automatically. right? But we don't question whether that's true, right? Is it true that you don't finish things? Or are there specific things that you haven't finished, right? They may never have questioned their choices, right? So things like conflict is a good one here, right? It's like we have this story that we tell ourselves, I don't do conflict. Anyone else got that? Yeah, I'm not a conflict person. Yeah, Cassie, I totally feel you. But we don't know why. Don't know why. It's like, oh, it just feels icky. It's kind of or it's uncomfortable. But we're not looking at, why is that a choice to not do conflict? What if we actually had some tools to be with conflict in a way that made it feel less uncomfortable? Right? And the fourth one is, we just may not feel resourced to do anything different. So it's like, oh, I'm sending this email. It feels edgy because I'm asking my boss a question and I kind of know what he's like or she's like. So I don't know how else to respond to that person. Right? I don't feel resourced to try anything new. Jane.
My question is just going back to the seven risks.
Oh, I can't hear you, love. Sorry.
Can you hear me?
Can do, yes. Yeah. Thank you.
My question is just going back to those seven risks.
Yeah.
My big one, I think, is abandonment, which doesn't feel quite the same as rejection. And I'm just wondering where it fits or whether it is just a different flavour of rejection.
Yeah, I tend to kind of put abandonment in with rejection.
Yeah. Maybe with a bit of disappointment in there too.
It's a kind of combo. Yeah. And look, this isn't the definitive list. So it's like, here's a start point.
Mm-hmm.
And your clients may have something that comes up. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, it's loss. You're worried about loss. Or humiliation can be another one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
themes. Yeah. Themes that might group similarities.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Cool. Nice. So the way that I sort of, the way that I'm pitching this module is that the key question we want to ask ourselves is, why is that alarm going off for this particular client? Right? Why is it that they feel they have to hold themselves back from doing this thing that they want to do or need to do in their lives? So we want to understand what has led to that sensitivity, right? The risk that's present when they contemplate taking that action is setting off this alarm. So why is that happening? Because we don't all experience risks in the same way. And often we don't always experience the same risks even in the same way, right? So we experience a variety of risks that are quite personal to us. And sometimes, you know, we can tolerate a risk depending on the context. Yeah. So what I have found is that the root causes of this sensitivity fall into kind of three main categories, right? And only one needs to be present for self-doubt to get activated. So the first one is the past experiences and memories of past experiences, right? How did I protect myself when I felt like this in the past? Right. So this often can come into those kinds of survival strategies that we talked about in the trauma-informed module. But also it's like, what did we learn growing up and in our teenage years and maybe even in experiences of working with this particular colleague, you know, if it's a work environment, how have I protected myself when I felt like this in the past? Right? Anything counts. Secondly, psychological safety, like how safe does it feel to be myself, to be vulnerable, to take risks, to make mistakes right now. Right? So how psychologically safe we feel in the current situation will help us to get a sense of if that's contributing to self-doubt. Right? So I think about someone who is going to be having a conversation with a family member, right? Past memories. How did I protect myself when I felt like this in the past? Maybe that family member is a bit more extroverted or domineering. Oh, I've got all of these memories of how I've managed them in the past. So that's making me hesitate from just saying what I want to say, right? How safe do I feel? Do I feel safe to be vulnerable with this family member? If I make a mistake or say something ineptly or don't quite get it right, is that going to be leapt on? What's the risk that's present for me right now? Yeah. And thirdly, the current context. Like, what am I thinking and feeling in this moment? Right. So even if there is no past memory of, you know, a difficult relationship with this person, and maybe there is some safety and you have evidence that it's safe for you to make mistakes and you belong in this relationship, but maybe you've had no sleep that night, or you're just feeling a bit unprepared, or you're sensing that that person isn't quite present, right? So it's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't say what I want to say. Right. This can happen in work situations as well. Right. How I've protected myself in my family when I met someone like this colleague. How safe is it to make mistakes in this work environment? Right. And I've just walked past my colleague in the communal kitchen and they didn't say anything to me. So I'm making it mean I don't think they like me very much. Or they're in a bad mood. So can I actually do this thing? Can I have this conversation? Right? And the thing about self-doubt is that we'll always try to protect us. So it's always going to give us a reason to hold back. So when we're listening to our protective self-doubt, we are more likely than not to listen to the risk or feel the sensitivity of the risk. Yeah. Do these kind of like contexts make sense to you all? Yeah, these three root causes. These are the situations that, or the context that will cause self-doubt to arise. So it's either something that's happened in the past, it's the wider context of this particular situation and how safe it feels right now, and it's that current, just in the moment, how am I feeling, what am I thinking, what's going on for me right now. Yeah, any one of these can lead to self-doubt arising in the moment. And what can happen is that these current contexts, right, if I have enough of them with the same person, I'm going to start feeling like I'm not safe with them, and now I've got to protect myself when I'm around them. Yeah. So we build in these stories to support us. Any questions or anything around those contexts or anything that's going on for you? Yeah, Scott.
I do apologize. If I'm taking space up at this present moment, because all I can hear is me. Oh, sorry to everybody else. That's really, really interesting. I have a situation where I have a cousin who I have a difficult relationship with. And I think she's a very strong character. And when my mom was diagnosed with having dementia, I refrained from going on a weekend away with family, because I knew that really like my mom. And I have created a narrative around my cousin. And when I listen to the narrative, it's kind of like can be like this, you can be like that. That's all I'm telling you now. But really, when I think about it, I've not put myself in a company for a while. And what started to become a lot clearer now is the reason why I do not put myself in a company is fear. Fear of humiliation, of being humiliated. But I didn't really want to admit that before. And there's more clarity around why I do take myself out of being in a company. Quite revealing, really.
It is, and I'm really stoked that you're sharing this. A, because I think it's super brave to do that. So bravo you. But also I think the more we know ourselves as practitioners, the more we understand, oh, that's a little activating for me. When I meet that kind of character type, I get a bit activated. If we're not attending to that, it means that when we see that in our clients, we are more likely to protect ourselves than say the thing that would most serve the client, right? And it means that we kind of get a bit entangled. Like, it's like both of our protectors are then having a conversation, but nobody's doing any coaching.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're both in that survival self mode. Yeah. Mm. I just want to, if you'll forgive me, Scott, I want to use your example as what happens here, right? So these three contexts, only one needs to be present for us to experience self-doubt. What happens is we filter any one of these or more than one in through our meaning making, right? What do I make it mean that this has happened? Notice that there is an element of choice in that when it becomes conscious, right? So just in stating that for yourself, Scott, acknowledging, oh, this cousin, actually, I have some fear of being humiliated. So you get to decide then, what am I going to make it mean? Am I going to make it mean something about me, something about your cousin, something about the wider context perhaps? You get to decide how you're going to respond to that in the future. And I'm not, of course, we're not going to talk about the solution now, but I just want you to see that that meaning making over time leads to our protective beliefs.
Yeah.
That's how our beliefs are formed. And we're going to spend next week really kind of diving into protective beliefs and talking about this a lot more. This week, we want to really think about that meaning making. What actually creates that? Because when we help our clients to make that meaning making conscious, which is often unconscious, it's like, it just feels horrible, or it feels risky, or I feel uncomfortable. There's a kind of blurring of what's going on. When we name it, we start to see that for our clients, this can be hugely liberating, because suddenly it's like, I'm naming what's happening. Now I get to really get a sense of what I want to do about that, right? But at the start, it's like all we want to help them to do is understand the meaning that they're making. Yeah. So I'm hoping this kind of makes sense for folks. Like, oh, this is why we kind of walk through the world holding these beliefs, right? They haven't just erupted out of nowhere, right? We've got these protective beliefs that say things like, I can't share with this person. It's not safe for me to be too visible, right? I shouldn't raise any kind of conflict with this colleague. That person doesn't like me, right? All of these beliefs that we have that protect us, that keep our sensitivity to particular risks alive, that make our self-doubt feel necessary, they're all coming from a really good reason. Right. And once we can resource our clients to, you know, really get curious about their meaning making, they can make different choices about how they respond. rather than just going, oh, that must mean this, and there's only one way to respond to it, we give them this sense of being resourced to make new choices. Yeah. Just want to check in. How's that kind of landing for everybody? Anyone want to share anything? Cassie, feel free.
It was interesting that I had this little pop light bulb moment when you were just sharing the three root causes. Because I keep going back to looking at my past to try and see why am I struggling so much right now with trying to set this coaching business up and being visible. And just when you said that psychological safety, I was like, oh, it's not the past, it's that. It's that idea of can I make a mistake? It's new. It's vulnerable. It's like, yes, that was quite interesting, that the understanding that it's not always one thing, like from your past or from the future or whatever it can be, as you just said, one of those three areas, and then that activates the risk that you're feeling.
I think I don't really follow Brené Brown. I actually find Brené Brown a bit insipid. I know you're not allowed to say that, but I know that she calls that thing the FFT, which is the first fucking time, right? So the first fucking time you do something, it's like, can I do this? Like, and it is incredibly vulnerable, and you know, it makes sense that our self-doubt would arise, right? So just in getting a sense of, I haven't yet created some safety around being myself, making mistakes, experimenting, letting this be vulnerable. So of course I've made this mean, I'm not doing it right, or there is a right way, and or something isn't, usually lots of clients will say things like, the universe just doesn't want me to, right? Because I haven't had the sign, right? So we make meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But imagine if you made a new meaning. What becomes possible then?
Yeah, that's a completely interesting way of looking at it. Because I keep looking back at my past, and but I was all like, I never had to second question myself. You know, I was running restaurants and opening restaurants and flying around the world, and just had to go and do it. And like, yeah, just go and effing do it. But like now, it's like I'm struggling so much, and it's like,
and just notice the difference, right? You've done these incredibly brave, amazing things, opening restaurants and running teams in this busy, high-paced environment. For anyone who's watched The Bear, you know this is a crazy old context to work in, right? A restaurant. But I wonder how much personal risk did you feel when you were doing those brave things?
None. And I'm realizing that I think that where that psychological safety comes from is that now it's just me, whereas I was always playing a part to a certain extent, because no matter what I was feeling, I had to leave it at the door because I'm putting on a show to a certain extent of making sure that all these customers are happy and smiley, happy, you know, and you just kind of, you plow through it no matter how, you know, even if you've worked 80 hour days and it's Christmas and you haven't even had a mince pie yet, or, you know, and you don't want to see another turkey dinner for the rest of the year. But, you know, you have to push through it, and you don't have a chance to second question yourself or think about it when you've got 350 people booked in for dinner that night.
Right. And so just notice that, right? Like by any objective measure, right, your career in running restaurants, opening restaurants, doing this in really brave stuff is, you know, astonishing. A lot of people would go, whoa, that is so scary and risky, and you're amazing, right? And this is often what can happen with our clients, is it's like, but I've done this stuff, right? Why can't I do this thing when this is the thing that I actually really want to do? This actually means something to me. And it's like, well, the answer's in the question, right? It means something to you, and it's personally risky to you. So of course that means that your sensitivity to it going a certain way is going to be heightened. Makes complete sense, right?
It does indeed.
Yeah. Such a great example. Yeah. So I just want us to play with this a little bit. I want to give you a sort of example of how I get into this stuff and just get a sense of meaning making from a client. Like, how do we get a sense of that? How do we understand what our clients making something mean? So I just want you all to take a moment to just write down anything that's coming up for you right now around your own self-doubt. Like, it might be that just in talking about this, you've got a sense of, oh, there's a particular relationship or a context that I'm in at the moment where I can feel self-doubt showing up. I'm holding myself back, right? So just note that down for yourself. And note down, like, any kind of thoughts or beliefs that are coming up around it. What are you making it mean that this is holding you back? I'm just going to take a couple of minutes, and then I'm going to ask someone to volunteer for some coaching. Got a context that has got some self-doubt in it and some beliefs around it. Yeah. Who wants to volunteer to get a little bit of coaching just so we can demonstrate how we look at that? Yeah. Jane. Oh, sorry, Scott, I saw you raise your hand. Jane, you go ahead, and we'll all get an opportunity to play with this.
Yeah, I don't know if this is...
Oh, I can't. There we go. I couldn't hear you there for a second, but I think I can now.
Oh, sorry, my microphone keeps cutting out today.
You're good.
Must be the rain. yeah, money.
Money. Okay, cool, money. So... Tell me a little bit about money. What's coming up for you?
Sort of conflicting thing of a strong feeling that I have to earn money. Mm-hmm. That comes from the kind of family values, if you like,
right.
Early childhood messages around money and safety. But equally strong, if not more strong, a real fear of earning money, of charging too much, of earning too much, of being seen to earn too much, and a fear of being judged, ostracized, criticized, talked about negatively, rejected.
So I'm hearing like a real tension. I've got to earn this money. That's a good thing. That's a value from the family, right? And if I earn too much, I'll be judged, criticized, rejected.
Mm.
What's that like for you in the middle there?
It's sort of like putting your foot on the accelerator all the time, but never taking your hand off the brake. So it's never easy. There's always loads of effort, but the brake's always on because you're scared of where that effort might take you.
I love that metaphor.
Yeah, it's about a very embodied sense of how uncomfortable it feels when you're driving a car and you've left the handbrake on.
I wonder, just as you're describing this, like how are you feeling about this, driving this car with the handbrake on, lots of effort going into acceleration?
Yeah, it's a very, how do I feel? Well, one, it's exhausting. It's a huge amount of effort. So, yeah, suddenly feel a sense of exhaustion at all the effort that goes into holding this very uncomfortable place. And also I feel real sadness, I think. Because I feel overlooked. It's like I'm trying to please these people and I'm trying to please these people and no one's seeing me. I can't be me. So, I don't even know what me is because I'm so busy making sure that I appease both these conflicting interests.
Yeah, it's almost like, are you really driving the car?
Yeah. Yeah.
What would it be like to either put the handbrake off, put it down, or take your foot off the accelerator? Like, what feels least risky?
Probably taking my foot off the accelerator because there is at least a greater set possibility of control there, whereas I'm quite scared of being out of control if I were to take the handbrake off.
So the greatest risk is of being seen and being visibly making more money. That feels more out of control. Am I hearing that right?
I think there's a fear of success which is around exhaustion. That I do feel very tired holding this uncomfortable position. And so if I take the handbrake off and everything explodes, then I worry that I haven't got the capacity or energy to sustain that.
Yeah. So I'm hearing that the risk is if I take my hand off the handbrake, show up fully and let myself earn what I want to earn, I'll burn out.
Yes, burn out and be lonely.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just want to reflect back, like, gosh, doesn't it make total sense that you would be holding this position when the alternative is to be burnt out and lonely?
Yeah. There's something, a strong thing about values as well, that I can't work with the people I work in, the sector I work in, earn money in a also in a way that's has I feel like it would go against all the values of the sector, the space I work in.
Right. Yeah.
So I feel like I have uncomfortable choices. I have to uphold those values, but not earn much money, or I have to leave that space in order that if I stay in that space and earn money, that I'm being inauthentic or there's conflicting values there.
Yeah. So I'm really hearing that. It's like, it's either this or that. Like, there's a lot of binary thinking, right? There's a lot of, if I do this, then this will happen.
I just realized that you said something about that in the handbook, that look out for the all or nothings. And I think at the time I thought, oh no, I'm always very, I always hold complexity. I'm rarely all or nothing. And I can hear myself going, yeah, it's either this or that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think this is such an interesting topic in that it has all the makings of, you know, your self-concept expanding, right? At the moment, there is like a conflict between values and desires.
Mm.
There's a lot of risk in there. There's ways that you're making sense of this. That it's just such a fantastic share for everyone. And I just want you to sit with, doesn't it make sense that you're sitting in the car with one foot on the accelerator and one foot on the brake? Because the meaning making that you're bringing to this is, if I do anything else, something bad will happen. So even though this isn't great, I'm in control. It's your hand on the accelerator and the brake.
Mm.
Like, when you think about what you get from maintaining this position, like, how is this working for you? How is it keeping you safe to stay where you are?
If I think about the psychological stages of development, it means that in relation to the forming stage, I can be safe and accepted in respect of my birth family, and while at the same time being safe and accepted in relation to my kind of chosen wider community. So I can sit in that forming stage with both of those conflicting sets of, if you like, communities. Whereas if I said, this is me, lump it or like it,
yeah.
This is just me, then I, in that sense of forming, I risk rejection from both those.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah.
So you've got a really clear idea of like what the benefits are of what you're maintaining a lot of relationships and keeping a lot of people happy. Mm. What's the cost of it?
Oh, that's what makes me want to cry, actually. Yeah. The cost of it is neither of those things are me. And there's so much more to me, and there's no space for that to fly and expand and Yeah, it means I'm stuck. I can't move. So that's that sense of like exhaustion, like being on a treadmill and not being able to get off it. Yeah.
Big cost. Mm. And like you said before, no one's noticing you.
Yeah, interestingly though, my husband notices, but he just doesn't understand. You know, I mean, he says, why don't you just do less? Why don't you just change? Why don't you just do less? I don't understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he does see the cost, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And my response to him is always, I can't. It's black and white. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So given what you've shared and where you're sitting in this situation, like, does it make sense to you that you're feeling this way? This exhaustion and sadness and tension that you've described?
Yeah.
Yeah. What does that do for you? Just going, oh, this kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting question, I think, because it makes sense. And I have moments of connecting with it in a kind of emotional way, the feeling of it, and then I cut it off. I can't stick with it. I go a bit cloudy. And I think there's another story underneath that's that makes it feel quite a difficult place to sit with that feeling of discomfort or understanding of the discomfort. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The cloudiness and that sense of, oh, I don't want to stay here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're both kind of stuck for damn good reasons and not wanting to be stuck.
Yeah, I don't want to sit and feel the stuckness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you do instead of feeling it? While you're stuck, what are you doing or not doing?
In relation to work and the question of, yeah, whether it's safe to earn money or not, I think probably what I do is a lot of perfectionist admin.
Nice.
And a lot of saying yes to free things or taking on a lot of little projects to avoid the really big projects. Yeah. Keeping really busy. Yes. Keeping really busy.
But not doing anything that would disrupt this fine balance you've struck.
Well, keeping really busy just does keep me stuck in that middle place.
But it doesn't disrupt it.
No.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to like bring this just to a close, because I think this is such a great place to leave it, Jane. And I guess what I'm hoping from folks watching is that you'll see all I'm trying to do with Jane's incredibly helpful context for us to explore this is to get a sense of like, what's going on? How is self-doubt showing up? What's this like for Jane? Like, what is she, how is she making sense of it? What the risks are? What she's feeling or not feeling? What happens when she is in that place? What the alternatives are? Like, all of these questions are aimed at, let's look at what's happening here. Let's get a sense of what is going on. What does this mean that you're in this place? And why does it make sense? What is it that is working about this situation? Right? How is staying here actually a safety mechanism? Questions, comments, observations. Let's hear it. What came up for you watching that? Just give me a wave. Yeah, Scott.
I really like the way you extracted the information. Because the questioning that you used, I think it really got Jane to think. You gave her that free time as well to really think. But I really love the sequence of questions that you used. And you could sit, to me anyway, watching Jane, looking at her face and watching her. I don't know if I'm right or wrong in saying this, Jane, but it's as if you did have some aha moments there. Can you hear me?
Aha moments, but also I think particularly the what's not working about this, I had a real embodied sense of that rather than a rational, like, I know this is not working and I should either move forward or stop, but I had a different embodied kind of response to that. But also interestingly, that I, when you asked me about I think you said, can you see why this makes sense, you know, or almost asking me to sit with it. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, this might take a while before I can sit comfortably with this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yes, Scott. Yes, I did. Thanks.
So just something to notice as well. I was trying to match Jane's pace. And you'll find this for some clients. They'll want to rush through it, and others will perhaps be more reflective and able to just sit and think. Some introverted clients will be like, I want to take this away and think about it. And I will always say, what's coming up for you right just in the moment? You know, just encourage people to create that safety so they feel they can share in the moment. Matching the client's pace and the gentle probing is the most important thing, right? Because all you're doing is sitting with them in it.
Can I ask about the pacing thing? Because I'm probably quite a slow reflective. That's my natural pace. But I have coached people who kind of talk a lot really quickly. So how do you slow them down? Because you want to match their pace, but at the same time, sometimes it feels like all the talk is just avoiding really reflecting and being present. So, And also, it's quite hard to stay in your own space if somebody's like really going fast. I've noticed before, sometimes it's easy to kind of speed up and then it all feels like it gets a bit out of control. So have you got any tips about that?
Yes. I think this is a form of distraction. It's a survivor strategy. When a client is not leaving any gaps and running on. So my approach is always to name that's what I'm observing. So I'll just say, can I just interrupt you? I just notice that you're talking quite quickly. Do you think you're talking quickly? Like, just get them to reflect on what's happening. Why might you be talking so much? What happens if you breathe and just kind of come back to yourself? So I'm just naming what I'm observing, right? And you can even say, does this feel uncomfortable to talk about? Do you want to talk about this? Right. So as you're like setting up the session, and I know for those of you who are experienced coaches, we'll start off. We'll say, what are we talking about today? What matters to you today? Where are you hoping to get to, perhaps? Or, you know, how will we know we've got there? What is it that you want to talk about? So whenever I'm hearing a client either veer way off in another direction or maybe staying with the topic but obfuscating by using those kinds of distraction techniques or whatever, I'll name it and I'll say, I just want you to know we're kind of veering into a different territory. What is that? Does that feel important to do that? Or, you know, I'm noticing that you're talking quite quickly and we're covering a lot of ground here, and I just want to either get you to notice that that's what's happening, or let's go back to what you said at the start about this thing, because often we'll reveal something and then our responses kick in and it's like, shit, distract, we don't want to talk about that thing, right? So it's like letting your client know that you've heard them and they can come back. It's safe to come back. Consent is important, right? Just asking, what is it that you want to talk about? Like, we're there to be of service to the client. So do they want to talk about this thing, or is that something they want to take away and think about? And then we'll talk about it next time. Yeah. Does that help? Yeah. Cool. Yeah, Cass.
As a fast talker when I'm a client, although I'm very calm and slow when I'm a coach, I once had a coach ask me to take a breath with her, and it made all of the difference. Because I think especially when I am being coached, I also am not an internal reflector. So a lot of what I'm saying is actually me reflecting out loud, which then could possibly be difficult for the coach to keep a thread of where my thoughts are going. So I've also found that when that a coach then has just picked up maybe two or three things and then reflected those back to me and said, am I getting the right gist here? Is this the right thing? So just as a client that can be a speedy talker, just thought I'd share that.
I think my third paying client ever did not stop talking for 52 minutes and I was a deer in headlights. I didn't know what the hell to do. I kept going to and she just kept going. And at the end, she sort of ran out of steam and I said, do you realize that you've talked for 52 minutes? I guess you had a lot to say. You know, it was like I didn't know what else to do. So yeah, it can be kind of like, what the hell is happening? No, not that bad, Cass. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because our clients will show up with their, like, you know, the current context can often be a source of self-doubt. Maybe there isn't safety built between us yet. So there may be a sense of, oh, I think I can trust you, but I'm not sure I'm ready to go there yet, right? So we just want to, you know, we get good at holding that space for the client, just giving them choices. Yeah, Jane.
I was just thinking about the coaching you just did with me, thank you. and because before when you were explaining the theory, I kept thinking, yeah, I understand the theory, but then again, it went hazy about really identifying the actual protective belief. Yeah. And so in the questions that you took me through, which I was in the middle of, so I can't really remember the pattern of it, but did you actually get to uncover the protective belief, or were we still just really exploring the reality and the territory and the meaning making? So yeah, you don't always get to the what's the belief in.
That's right. And I think we were just kind of playing with the meaning making. That took about 10, 15 minutes maybe. So I think if we had had a full session, we probably would have been able to play with what do we think the protective belief is that's sort of in the driver's seat? You know, what is going on here? Sometimes that doesn't happen. And, you know, my approach to this work is always, you know, don't worry about trying to tie every session up in a neat bow, right? Actually, it's sometimes we just sort of have to trust that we'll get there. So it may be that if we'd had time, and because I think you are a naturally, you're quite an advanced reflector, we probably would have got to a protective belief after that process. But for some clients who aren't, or who find it a bit tricky to know what they are experiencing, that might not have happened. Yes.
So the bit where I just went really fuzzy, and I said, oh, I think there might be something here somewhere, but I don't want to look at it. So I suspect then that's probably what the protective belief underneath is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it may well be. And I would also say, I'm also aware, Jane, that you're good at working hard at things. So it may be that when it feels hard, you're like, oh, the answer's in there, so I'll try hard, right? So I'm just conscious that it may come to you in the shower tomorrow morning. Oh, that's the protective belief. And it may naturally arise and it be very ease-filled. And wow, that would be interesting. Maybe you don't have to work hard to find that belief, you know? So I'm just, you know, conscious of as we get to know our clients, we might find, oh, sometimes we can like use our own protective mechanisms to kind of make life tricky for ourselves. You know, our clients can do that. So I'm just aware of time. What I'm hoping is that this has helped you to just get curious about that meaning making. What is it that is setting off that alarm, right? And, you know, we will talk about this as we go, but very much like nothing's gone wrong. The client's not doing anything wrong. There's nothing to fix, right? There's a protective mechanism at work here. The last thing we want to do is whip that out from the client and say, right, everything that you're creating safety for yourself with, however kind of unhelpful that might be, we don't want to take that away from the client, right? We want to help them to feel more resourced within that context. So really giving yourself a break to let this be an exploration without a defined specific outcome can be a real gift to your client. Yeah. What I'd love you to do is take this approach of exploring meaning making into your practice pods. So you may want to take the context that you've written down some notes on and explore that in your practice pods. How can you coach one of your pod mates around their meaning making? What questions come up for you? Right? There's no formula, right? But if you're thinking about how does that client make sense of this context? What questions do you want to ask? Yeah. Just to get to a place where, oh, it kind of makes sense. We've got an idea of what the risk is, why this is serving the client in some way. And I'd also really love you to complete your life maps if you haven't already. Give that a go. as Kirsty said, it can be a fun-filled experience at 5 a.m. but yeah, just do that for yourself. It's going to be something that you may refer to again and again as we go through these first modules. It can also give rise to just more understanding of why risks are appearing the way they are for you right now. So that's the kind of homework for this week, is to start playing with meaning making in your pods and do your life map for yourself over the next week or so. Yeah. Sound good? Okay. If questions come up or you want to explore different things, anything that's in the workbook or the videos or anything like that, feel free to use the discussion forum for that. And we'll also have study group on Thursdays with Scott. You're so, so welcome to attend that to explore more. Okay. All right, loves. Take care of yourselves, and I'll see you next week. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thanks.